This week on the show, Apple finds a few Beatles in its iTunes. Crackle gets some backwash. Africa goes digital. And the Facebook Monetary Fund. Right here on This Week in Media, number 210. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to This Week in Media. This is Alex. And we have the usual suspects. I mean, this is as usual as we get, you know, on the show. We've got Daisy Whitney coming back as she's guesting with us today. Hey, Daisy.
Hello, Alex. It is a pleasure to be a guest. I haven't been a guest on This Week in Media for more than 2 years.
So I know. It was a luxury I got to do because, you know, yeah. I actually enjoy being a guest because then I get to pontificate more often rather than just ask questions.
Yeah, you know? And I'm not always the pontificator, so I'm going to have short, pithy answers.
Yes, no, maybe.
Yes. Exactly.
So and we'll talk a little bit more about your book here in a second. And also Tim Street, of course, coming in from L.A. Hey, Tim.
Hey, I'm really glad to be here on this special day because our first story that we'll get into in a minute, I'm celebrating. I'm doing this episode. I'm recording this episode in bed, naked, with Yoko Ono. Well, wait, Yoko, she got stuck in traffic. But other than that, I'm doing it in honor of the big announcement today.
Okay. And also coming in from local online news, Lon Seidman. Hey, Lon.
Hello.
You're in Florida, right?
I am in Florida, just outside of Palm Beach, enjoying myself.
And just hanging out in Florida?
Just hanging out.
Seeing when things are going to, when they're going to light up the sky?
Exactly. Well, I had a vacation planned, so I've been home, and now I'm back again on vacation. And then we're looking at November 30th now at 4 o'clock in the morning, wow. Which will then require a third trip to Florida, which I'm not complaining about.
You're getting more Florida than you had in your entire lifetime.
Yeah, it's great. I think I might just, you know, move here. Yeah.
Evidently, I hear that the houses are relatively affordable.
It's a good time to buy.
Yeah. Yeah. What were we going to say,
Daisy? I have to say, seeing a shuttle take off is pretty cool. I actually got to see one when I was in high school. My dad was in the news business. So we went to one of the launches. I was 15 or 16. And so when it finally happens, it's pretty amazing.
I had a friend who had, as a teenager, had gotten himself somehow into the press corps for the Apollo launches.
Whoa!
Yeah, and he was so he had lots of stories from that. So it was so anyway. So I'm very jealous. We talked about it last week that I was a huge shuttle fanatic in my childhood years, and so it's kind of sad to see the last one.
We used to skip school and go. I grew up in Orlando. And we would skip school and go, the best is a night launch. Yeah. Night launch, by far, the best.
Yeah. Yeah, my mom actually let me take school off because I was such a science kid that this was considered, as far as she was concerned, so it was a learning experience. That was my story, and I was sticking to it.
It's educational.
So now the big announcement, as Tim has alluded to, there was a big announcement. Everyone was waiting with bated breath that Apple was going to do something on their website, and there was a lot of, you know, that it was never going to be the same because they were going to change everything. And we felt like, you know, Apple, you know, of course they're used to magical things and everything else, but, you know, usually they don't say things like tomorrow will never be the same and, you know, that type of thing. We thought it was going to be huge. We thought it was going to be a subscription, and it turned out to be the Beatles back catalog. Finally on iTunes. Tim, are you excited?
I'm very excited. You know, I'm a little disappointed from that there's no subscription because I really wanted to subscribe to my Beatles tunes. But, you know, the other thing that is amazing when you look at this is like we're kind of going, well, it's kind of a non-news story, but it's everywhere today. I mean, everybody is covering this. And it's like you don't hear anybody going, oh, hey, the Jimmy Buffett catalog just came to the iTunes store.
Yeah, you know? But I guess I wonder if that's a function of how much hype that Apple really put into it. You know, I mean, it's like there was a lot of hype, and so it seems like everyone kind of opened what Apple was really good at, because they've done so many of these big announcements, is getting everybody to carve out where they're going to put this in the paper. Whatever Apple's going to talk about, we're going to put it in there, and then Apple, you know, in my opinion, kind of drops the bomb.
Sure, sure. You know, they did, but it's still, you know, a testament to how engaging that music is, you know? I mean, for them to step out with it regardless of whether it's a news story or not, it does say something about that music.
Now, do we think, Daisy, do you think that any of this, the timing of this or anything else might have been connected to EMI's financial problems? I mean, they have to find every way they can find to make money.
Well, everything is connected to finances, and it's foolish of us to think otherwise. So, you know, when you hear about, a story in the New York Times about Zagat's, the restaurant guide, having had an opportunity to sell previously and it didn't sell, it all comes back to finances. So EMI is in financial trouble. Sure, that has to be an impetus. This is not just about art at all. I mean, if this is something that's going to help the company and if it's something they've been holding out on, well, it's kind of amazing how a few dollars can make the difference. In terms of the significance, I think this is like the Star Wars of the music business, right? I mean, when you think about really sort of,
we still don't have our Blu-ray Star Wars. Not that
well, and we need to have a big announcement and allocate space to it when that finally does happen. But I think it is of the same significance in terms of, pop culture resonance. And there's something really interesting in one of the stories that a Forrester analyst had said, that the fact that securing, as Forrester analyst Mark Mulligan said, the fact that securing the content of a band old enough to be most young music fans' grandfathers is a sad reflection of the state of the digital music market. I have to vehemently disagree with that. It's not just young people that use iTunes. It's all of us. And there are a lot of people of our generation, our parents' generation, who only consume music that way and are going to be buying this. This is going to be a big boon to digital music. And it also is going to be an opportunity to expose this music to the younger generation as well.
Well, I think especially the audience below us and above us, because I think that above us, I can see my parents, haven't bought any CDs for a long time. I mean, since I bought them an iPod and my dad just got an iPhone, they just buy all their music on iTunes. And so he doesn't really, he doesn't know how to really rip CDs. He just knows how to buy stuff on iTunes and he buys a lot of it. And so for him, being able to get the Beatles collection makes sense. For my kids who might be reintroduced to it, might look at it, that might make sense. For me, I think in our generation, I don't know, most people that I know, if they like the Beatles, already had the Beatles in their iTunes library. And there's they either ripped the CDs that they owned, or they found them somewhere online, evidently, because the CDs have been out and they've been digitized. And so a lot of that stuff's been floating around. And so it doesn't seem like it's that, I think for a lot of people, have had these in their library for a long time. So I think that the main market that started with iTunes, I think may not be there. But I think that there is that younger and older audience. Lon, are you going to be buying the Beatles on iTunes?
No. It's I'm probably the wrong person to ask. I'm not a huge Beatles fan. I certainly like the Beatles, but my wife is. But she already has the CDs already on her iTunes that she put on there years ago. So, I think this is a bigger deal to Steve Jobs than it might be for the rest of his customers. And the Beatles have always been a really important part of him. And if you remember when George Harrison passed away, they turned the entire front page of Apple to a memorial to him. And I think a large part of what was driving this marketing effort and this announcement that really for me wasn't that big of a deal was probably driven a lot by the boss on this.
I mean, it almost seems like Apple almost got into tunnel vision of we just need to add the Beatles. They have everything else. It's like it's for the company that has everything.
Right.
The Beatles. the last thing that they didn't have was the Beatles. And I don't think they're going to do the same thing for AC/DC or, the handful of other bands that are holding out.
Yeah.
I don't think they really care. I think that this definitely seemed like it was a feather in a cap that they just had to have.
There's something to be said for that, Alex. I really do. And I think part of what Apple has done so well, one of the reasons you admire the company and we all do, and now just, much broader than those of us ensconced in the tech business, is because of the image, is because of sort of this pristine, very controlled, very all-encompassing, company that is just, methodically, systematically and artfully dominating a lot of the media business. So even if it's sort of symbolic, there's something to that symbolism about the role that Apple now has, as a financial player, as a media player, as kind of a centerpiece, of our media economy.
And I think there's definitely a push to make sure that they weren't the ones left out, that Amazon didn't get the Beatles library and iTunes, if Amazon got it and Apple didn't have it, that would have been even more of an upset, in some ways for Apple. So I think that, anyway, so we'll see how it goes. I'm sure sales will be brisk. And there'll be a lot of people kind of building up on those if they need to. It's nice that it came out after all the DRM stuff was gone, so that you're able to just buy the CD straight away. Next story is, you know, one that I think that is, I don't think it's gotten, I don't, maybe I've been missing the press. I haven't seen a ton about this, you know, floating around. To me, when it came out, it should have been, you know, the thing that we saw the most of. And this is Facebook credits. Okay, so this is according to Advertising Age, Ian Schaefer, is that, you know, basically, you know, these are like, he's making them like the arcades, you know, where you could buy a bunch of credits and then be able to use them. And we see this a lot. I mean, if I buy a lot of images off of iStock Photo, for instance, I buy a whole bunch of credits. So I buy credits from iStock and then I re-spend them. And I spend them over long periods of time buying stock photos that we need for our business. And so we you know, it's not something that's unheard of to do these kind of, you know, you're buying these points. But essentially what's happening, though, is that we're, you know, Facebook is going to let you buy these. And at first you're going to be able to use them with virtual items like Zynga. But it also looks like you're going to be able to use them to buy a lot of other things and possibly be able to eventually use them to buy things in the physical world. And one of the interesting things about it for a retailer is possibly that you don't end up with credit card charges. You don't have to worry about any kind of credit back and forth. I mean, you do with Facebook, but you're not... You know, you're not waiting for the people who have bought the Facebook's credits, put the money into it. The money's already gone from their perspective, and they're just using up these credits. This is a, you know, with 500 million users, we're not talking about something that is an experiment. I mean, this is, you know, Facebook is, I think, the third or fourth largest country in the world by users. So that's something to think about, and they're global. And so you have a lot of people using these credits. If they start using them all over the world, it possibly has an impact. Daisy, do you think, is this a big deal? Is it really going to turn out to be something that impacts the world in a big way?
I think it's very important to track what happens with this, because I think that virtual goods and virtual worlds are sort of this quiet but very powerful sector of the digital marketing economy. We had a session on virtual goods at AdTech New York that I just programmed a couple weeks ago along with my colleagues. And, you know, the subtitle for the session was something along the lines of, you know, you would be shocked how much money is in virtual goods, which, even though everybody knows that people are playing Farmville and Mafia Wars and so on, and, you know, buying things online, there is an astonishing amount of brand money, I mean, close to billions of dollars, that is going into virtual goods, and it is being driven by this consumer demand. So I think that's what's really important to keep in mind as the backdrop to this is that this is really playing into an existing and, you know, proven consumer desire that isn't always talked about. And like you said, this hasn't necessarily gotten a lot of coverage yet because everyone's talking about Facebook Mail. But this actually has the potential to be significantly more important. And I think we should definitely keep a close eye on it.
Lon, when McDonald's accepts Facebook credits, is this the end of the U.S. dollar?
It could very well become a very competitive currency. You think about the fact that Facebook has 500 million users at least, and even if you get rid of some of the fake profiles out there, there's easily 300 or 400 million people, if not 450 million people, using this thing. And if this becomes a currency, you know, you're almost looking at a stateless entity here that has some significant pull. And I've been thinking more about this whole idea of a stateless organization. You know, the whole WikiLeaks thing kind of brought that out, that, you know, how do you stop it, right? In the case of Facebook, certainly there's financial regulatory guidelines that they'll have to abide by, but nonetheless, they're creating a whole separate, almost a whole separate country.
Well, I mean, here's the thing is that beyond buying just virtual goods, and there's also services. So, for instance, mm-hmm. The way we do a lot of our bidding is I don't really pay people per hour. Oftentimes I pay them per piece, you know, so I need this right. animation. I need this thing. I need, you know, whatever. People hire me per piece. I hire other people per piece, and it's just kind of what it is. What happens if I start buying, if I buy $10,000 worth of credit and then I pay everybody in all the artists, credits instead of cash, you know, and the reason is I got artists that are spread out in 40 countries. And so the right. thing is that now I don't have to deal with all the all the transfers and all the tax issues and all the, they have to deal with them when they cash them out. But I don't have to do it if they do. Right. That's the point. If they do. And that's exactly what the issue is that what happens when this becomes a completely closed economy and no one cashes the credits out? It means that there's a lot on, you know, and this, you know, yeah, it changes the model.
And Facebook makes a ton of money on the interest they earn from the real cash that's sitting in the bank representing those credits too, which is probably exactly why they're doing this. And the other factor that you can think about is, as a real significant thing, is think about reputation attached to a profile in the sense of eBay giving you a feedback rating. Well, here on Facebook, when your profile has you as a very reputable person on Facebook, which I'm sure you would certainly be labeled as, people will want to do business with you. And in fact, you may almost feel encouraged to use the Facebook currency system more than you would doing some kind of offline deal, because that feedback will become something that helps you sell yourself and your business out to other people in the future. So this is a big deal. And I think the fact that it is quiet is probably what Facebook wants right now, is they want it to get huge quietly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, because I mean, the question for you, Tim, is when do governments start eyeing this up? Are they going to miss the boat for a couple of years and not realize how what this means?
No, we're going to be paying Facebook tax in no time. I don't think they'll miss it. Where I see this thing getting huge is that on Facebook, you get to see when it's somebody's birthday. Now, wouldn't it be great to just click on a button and buy them the thing that they want on their birthday?
Yeah.
Yes, I mean, that is huge.
Or gift them credits. You know, the thing is that, you know, just send them, here's 20 credits, here's 50 credits.
And so that works on so many levels. I mean, right now, if I'm on Facebook and I see it's somebody's birthday and I want to buy them a song or a video, it's not real easy to do. I have to go to another site. I have to, you know, it's a couple emails, right? And log it into different things. Whereas I could just click on a button and buy them the thing. They get their Facebook message and everybody's happy.
Yeah. So it's going to be it's going to be fascinating. It definitely makes things a lot more efficient from a, you know, especially when you're looking at buying and selling things globally. You know, in a global market, having a global organization, and it would have been, you know, it's, I think this in many ways is where something like PayPal wanted to go. You know, this was the idea. You know, these micropayments and so on and so forth, but being able to do it here, I mean, I think that it's interesting to see. I mean, Daisy, do you think that this is interesting timing given all the issues around currency in the world at the moment?
Currency is a big mess, isn't it?
It is, isn't it? The whole idea, like,
well,
what happened?
You know what I was just thinking when Tim said that? You know who's really going to make the money in this? Obviously, it's Facebook. Because think about all of the uncashed credits. Think about, oh, it's so-and-so's birthday. I'm giving you $2 to buy a song. And I forget, you know, Tim gives that to me on Facebook. I forget to cash it in. And Lon forgets to cash it in. You forget to cash it in.
But you'll have a little bank account. You'll have a little bank account of Facebook credits.
But then it'll expire, like your airline points at some point.
If it expires, absolutely. And it should. The thing is that typically, you know, your airline tickets, your airline miles expire, from what I understand, is specifically to keep them from being taxable. You know, because it's not a hard, right, hard asset. So if they expire, you might be right, but they haven't said anything about that yet.
I think if this does become, I mean, I love the idea that you talked about, Alex, you know, paying people all around the world, because we're all doing business globally in different ways and, you know, trying to find ways to avoid that. But that stuff is going to get figured out, and there are going to be rules and regulations that get put in place realistically. If it starts becoming clear that a lot of people are using this system to pay contractors in foreign countries and, you know, sort of avoid the, you know, the taxes and fees, then there will be rules.
Well, I mean, the argument really is that they still have to, theoretically, they would still have to pay those taxes and fees. You're still paying it on the income that you're making. So in some ways, you know, you're still paying it. You're still paying the tax on your end. I still pay the tax because I'm still paying the taxes on my income, you know, and then I'm paying, you know, and they're still paying the taxes if they take the money out to pay for their rent or computers or whatever. But yeah, the big thing is that if people don't take it out, you know, they're able to move, and everybody's right, using the same system. They're able to move a lot of value around really, really quickly without, you know, and I think, you know, it could be a couple of years before we figure it out. And the thing is that it has to be done in every country. Right now, what suddenly happens is you have a unified currency, more unified than the U.S. dollar, more unified than anything else, and then you have a bunch of fractured countries who don't know how they want to argue, you know, how they want to agree to anything. And so it could take years and years and years of negotiations worldwide to figure out how to deal with this. You know, and in between, it could become the, you know, I mean, it, I don't think it will, but there's an outside chance it could become the de facto currency for the intellectual market.
You know? Well, and it's an amazing idea. That's the other thing. It's really an amazing idea that just, you know, through technology and through media, that something like this is even possible simply as a discussion point, because it is happening and it is rolling out. So the prospect of it is possible.
Right.
That's oil. What's really fascinating.
What were you saying, Tim?
Oil is now trading in Facebook credits.
What is now
stable that way?
Oil.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah. That's when we know. That's when we know.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, and as you know, we had talked about credits. I mean, we've been talking about credits internally to move services around inside the PixelCorp more as a training operation than anything else for a decade. You know, in fact, so it's something that I spent a lot of time looking at. When I saw it, I was just like, yep, it's not exactly what I would have done, but it's bigger because they're a lot bigger than we are. So anyway, it'll be very interesting to see how that turns out. The internet TV battle continues to fire up here. There's a lot of talk here with the FCC. And you know, one of the things that people are trying to, and this is from the Washington Post, is that they're trying to push, you know, standardize the set-top box, standardize how that's integrated, standardize how that's handled. And of course, the cable companies have no interest in that. TV networks don't have any interest in that because they want to control that. And of course, Google TV and other set-top boxes want that to be standardized. They want people to be able to handle that. Daisy, do you think that the FCC could actually standardize this, or could actually force a standardization of this?
I don't think so. No, it's
complex.
I don't have a lot of faith in the FCC or other governmental agencies to really sort of affect a solution here that's significantly going to change people's business. I mean, I think, you know, there obviously are a lot of holdups with the Comcast NBC merger, and there are things like that where you can understand why they're getting involved. But in terms of, you know, standardizing the technology, I also just feel like there's so many competitors already, and I think the marketplace is saying, despite some of the troubles that Google TV has encountered in its early rollout, I think that the marketplace is essentially at work, and you know, these very viable competitors have emerged, and certainly cable has plenty of competitors in satellite, and obviously the telcos, AT&T and Verizon, are now becoming, you know, really strong competitors as well. And I guess maybe because they're stronger, they're now effectively the incumbents, but just a few years ago they were the little guys in this field.
Tim, can do you think the cable companies can stop the slide of becoming just dumb pipes?
It's a tough one. I mean, if they buy up the content, like say they were a big cable company and they bought like a big network, like, you know, like
possibly like Comcast and NBC.
Yeah, possibly like them. Maybe they could stop the slide. Maybe they had some foresight, some vision. It's tough. I don't know. I really don't have the answer to that. I mean, I look at this and it drives me crazy, because it's like, okay, you can buy a 42-inch plasma, LCD, whatever you want, right? And you can hook up your cable box to that, and you can hook up your computer to that, right?
Right.
And you can watch either one on there. Now, can you buy a 27-inch iMac and hook your cable up to that?
You can.
Yeah. See, that reaction is the reaction that I got in the Apple store yesterday when I went in. Because I was like, well, what if I just bought one of these 27 inches? Can I hook up my cable? And they asked four or five people. They went on the internet. They went.
Well, I believe you can. You just do an HDMI conversion to an ADC, or into the mini converter, mini
display port. Right. And the answer they came back with was only if you do it in target mode, which like even threw me into a loop further. Like, really?
Right.
Really? That doesn't make sense to me. But it's crazy. This is a battle, and it feels like they're just going to be putting roadblocks in front of us when it's what consumers want. We want all the options that are out there that are of value to us, where there's a value proposition, and we're willing to pay for that value proposition. We just want to get at it. Stop putting a hurdle in front of us and figure out a business model that's going to work.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I know that I went to Home Depot and bought a bunch of pieces of metal and a hacksaw, and I installed a little thing to set my iPad up over my exercise bike.
Wait, what did you buy?
I bought a bunch of pieces of metal and a hacksaw.
Oh, you must be on a government watch list now.
Yeah, exactly. Once you get a hacksaw. No, it was, I was trying to find the perfect thing and I couldn't find it. And I finally just got angry on Sunday and went to Home Depot and just started just buying stuff that I figured I could cobble into something. And so after about a half an hour and a lot of duct tape and some cutting, I ended up with something that works fairly well. And I have, but the only reason I wanted to be able to do it is because I want to watch Netflix, my Netflix Instant Play on my iPad while I'm biking. So, you know, and that, you know, cause I get bored biking. And, but when I looked at it and I was like, man, I have lost all interest in TV. You know, like I don't watch it at all anymore. You know, sometimes I watch some of the shows here and there, but I just, you know, I don't want to watch it anymore. I think that's the real issue. And I think that's the possibly what the uphill battle that they're dealing with. Lon, do you, what do you see yourself watching in 5 years? Do you think this is going to sort itself out in the next 3 to 5 years?
I think consumers probably will. I can tell you from my standpoint, I got that piece of junk Comcast DVR at home that's getting tossed back to the cable company as soon as I get back from my 12 trips to Florida, because it just doesn't work properly. It's expensive. And quite honestly, it's, you know, the stuff for some strange reason, the shows that I like to watch, some stuff on the Sci-Fi Network, a few other channels, I get them in HD like the next day on in demand, but I don't get on demand, but I don't get them off the air in HD. It's just because my cable company doesn't provide me those networks that way. And from my perspective, I'd much rather cut back my monthly fees, go with the dumb pipe, and then pay for the stuff that I want to watch. And I don't know why, you know, all this talk about the cable company not wanting to be a dumb pipe. I think they make more money being the dumb pipe and perhaps controlling some of the content creation that goes over those pipes. It's probably why Comcast has been out there acquiring smaller cable networks and now going for NBC, is that they don't have to deal with all that negotiation, fiber fees, and the other things that we've talked about before. So I think where it is going is that we will probably buy the connection and then have a lot more choice in how we spend our dollars, and Comcast will still facilitate some of those purchases. And I think that's where it's going to go. The problem is that right now, the people that do that kind of stuff are people like us who are savvy enough to hook all this junk up to our TV and make it work. And I think that's the next step in the battle here, is getting some of these networks to give up a little bit of control, which is going to be a problem.
Well, and in our next story here, we have this, you know, so this is a filmon.com. They are offering for $9.95 per month, you can get over 30 premium free-to-air television channels. The Filmon, it's available on the web and for Apple's iPad for free. This is according to Reuters. And of course, you know, they put this up, and very quickly they got a cease and desist from CBS, Walt Disney, I mean ABC, NBC, Fox. Everyone got a little tied up in a knot about this process. Now, of course, the founder says that that it's something that he believes that he can do. He says that they're free to air, and so we're airing them. I mean, that's not a direct quote, but that's basically, he said, I'm not a thief. We're a bona fide business. We're not pirates. And of course the Hollywood is a little less excited about it than he is. So, Tim, does Filmon have any leg to stand on here? Is he trying to find a loophole that isn't there?
It's interesting. If you take a look in England, there's a company, I think it's called TV Ketchup or Ketchup TV, that does the same thing, and they're somehow getting through it on a loophole. So I think it really depends on how the FCC regulations are on this, and is he doing anything? I mean, if you were Sony and you made a Watchman that picked up the signals, isn't that kind of the same thing?
Right. It's the redistribution that, of course, they're arguing. Now, what's interesting is that broadcast companies for a long time were fighting to make sure that they got included in all these distribution. You know, they just want to make sure that they reached all those eyeballs. And so free-to-air, you know, free-to-air is a lot of international channels as well. There's a lot of other things.
I'm sure free-to-air did a Netflix deal and said, hey, here's $4 billion. They'd have absolutely no problem with it.
Right. Daisy, what does free-to-air really mean?
That's a good question. I'm not going to pretend that I am an expert in knowing that. But I think that what's at play here and what's at play with the whole concept of free over the air is the whole idea that it's fine for it to be free to consumers. You know, that there are certain expectations, you know, as sort of part of the FCC, part of accessibility of airwaves and all of that. That, you know, consumers be able to tune into a PBS, a CBS, an NBC, and so on without paying for them. But you have to kind of back into that. And I think that's what Philmon isn't doing. It's kind of, you know, jumping over all of the steps that all of those players had to take in order to be in a position to offer free over-the-air service to consumers. That's what... That other company, you know, IVI and Philmon are trying to do. And they're saying they're not pirates, but I feel like they're probably a little bit closer to piracy, that if you want to do this and you want to find an alternative method to offer TV, you have to go through some official hurdles. You have to set things up in some official and proper ways to be able to do this. This reminds me of the early days, you know, 4 years ago when Google Video was Google Video, and now it's all folded into YouTube, and Google was carrying certain videos without permission from the content providers, and Google realized it actually had to play nice and establish relationships with content providers to be able to offer that content on YouTube and Google. Google has done that. Google has made clear in a lot of ways, not all the time, but in a lot of ways, that it is a friend of Hollywood and entertainment companies, and that has been important to part of kind of the makeover that we've seen as Google has had to become an entertainment and media company as well. So I think that you can kind of cast these terms about, but you have to have some actual business processes and procedures in place and play by some of the rules that the other people are playing by in order to wave that free over the air flag.
Now, Lon, do you should they really be trying to stop this? I mean, do they need to get all the eyeballs that they can get, or do they need to make sure that this cat doesn't get out of the bag?
I think they're probably going to want to prevent this cat from getting out of the bag. And it's actually interesting they're going after it on copyright first, because there's also some FCC regulations about this goes back to direct broadcast satellite. When that first came out in the mid-90s, you had to prove to the FCC or whatever the regulatory authority was that you couldn't actually receive those TV networks over the air before they would allow you to look at a New York network that you'd get over satellite. I don't know if you all remember that, but I'm sure that'll be the next step, because there are some rules about retransmission of local broadcasters over other means. And this comes also back to, again, these fees that cable companies are paying and frequently fighting with local affiliates about. And that comes back to getting money for each subscriber that those cable networks, or in this case, an internet network, delivers to. And again, this disambiguation of the internet creates all these difficult situations like this. And
it's no longer clean. It's no longer three networks that just divvy up the market. It's messy.
And people are ultimately going to go where they want. And the music industry is a great example of that. Right. And I would imagine the best thing, and maybe this is where Hulu is trying to find its place, is to try to create an environment where they can do it in such a way that they still have some control and some revenue coming in for it.
So speaking of revenue and possibly some control, this is according to Yahoo Entertainment, of course. Backwash is a new video that just came out on Crackle. It just came out, I believe, yesterday. And it's a 13-episode series that has a lot of main actors, A-level actors or close to A-level actors. John Hamm, John Stamos, Sarah Silverman, John Cho, and, you know, the long list of people who we've seen in many other, you know, TV shows and videos. And we don't usually see this on the web. The first one came out, and they're really, you know, trying to create, like, can we create a web series that is, you know, that's popular? Has anyone actually seen the show, Backwash?
No, but I want that salami to give to my dog. He's sending out a giant salami to promote it. Okay, sorry.
I tried to get on the set to do interviews for my blog, and they wouldn't allow me because, I mean, Crackle lets me on sets all the time, but they said that they had struck deals with all the talent that they would only do the web series, but no PR. And so I wasn't allowed to go shoot behind the scenes or anything. And I was like, okay.
Here's the interesting thing about all this. As I saw it, you know, I watched it before the show when I was doing research for the show. And I, you know, It was like a medium quality SNL skit, in my opinion. You know, nothing groundbreaking, nothing, you know, it's a little bit more production value than you see on SNL, but the writing was about, to me, was about the same. You know, and it was, you know, it didn't feel like it had as much passion as I would expect, you know, or what we need. And the question is that, is this a box? And this is for you, Daisy. Is this a box that Hollywood's going to have a hard time getting into? You know, this idea of webisodes, of doing something edgy enough that's either, you know, that has what it needs to actually, you know, create that viral market.
Well, we've really still haven't. We've been talking about this for years. I mean, we talked about this a lot 2 years ago with Dr. Horrible. We've really yet to see a really powerful jump from the web to TV. Of course, there's Sanctuary on Sci-Fi, and now Sci-Fi has got this other show that it's testing out and, you know, potentially considering for a crossover. But Sanctuary, you know, as I understand it, was really designed from the get-go to almost be kind of like a test run for TV. And yeah, they're just, it seems as if there is still this giant wall between the two. The New York Times is now covering web series. I read the piece that they did over the weekend on it. And yeah, there is just, it's, you know, I think it comes down to, you know, what plays in Peoria doesn't always play in the rest of the country. And I think that's some of what's happening. Like, we know that, you know, funny one-off viral videos work really well and can have a universal appeal. But, you know, a lot of these other things, I mean, if you took like a 1 minute section from, you know, from The Office or 30 Rock or even some of our edgier TV shows, if you can even call them that, and put that on the web without somebody ever having seen the rest of it before and understand the context, would that be funny? I mean, that's sort of part of what is going on here. I think it's a little bit of the medium. But if this is truly just a place to groom it for TV, that's a different story.
You know, this
might just be a rollout plan.
Right, Tim?
You bring up something really interesting, Daisy. Do you think in the early days of TV, people were saying, you know, when is there going to be a TV show that's good enough to put on radio?
or to be made into a movie or something, right? I mean,
yeah,
that's probably,
yeah.
That might be what we say all the time.
What my question is when are we going to have a hit web series that people talk about the way that they talk about a hit TV show?
And there's been some. I mean, there's been some like niche ones. You know, The Guild has built up a following.
But nobody in Peoria knows. I mean, there are people.
Exist.
Yeah, it's like kids know Fred. Kids know Annoying Orange. But other than that, there's no like Uncle Milty of the internet.
Right.
That person has not. There was a time where we thought, oh, maybe it's going to be Conan. Maybe it's going to be. But, you know, it just hasn't happened yet. There isn't a true celebrity that has come to the internet and created a show, or organically, someone who's created a show that has become water cooler talk for everyone. I mean, people know what YouTube is, but they don't know what Lonely Girl 15 is.
Right, right. Lon, do you think that they can make this? Do you think Hollywood's going to be the one that makes this, or do you think it's going to be someone outside of the Hollywood market that's going to figure out how to make this web series work?
I think early on, the marketing muscle that Hollywood can bring is probably pretty powerful, and clearly a studio is behind this Crackle thing and this whatever they call it, the Backwash series on it. So I think initially that might be the case, but I think Tim's point is a good one, that there isn't a lot of curation yet, and I think the curator, whoever figures that out, will probably become the most powerful person in new media that people will want to flock to and get on their radar screen. Another thing, I know that Crackle is on Boxy. Are they on any of the other boxes out there? I don't think Apple TV has
on Roku.
And I think that's a big thing here too, that it's on Boxy, which is probably the box the least number of people own at the moment. Maybe people that hook their laptops up do a lot of Boxy, but I'm interested in seeing how they develop this a little bit more, if they're going to go to Apple TV, or if being a Sony-owned property means that they're going to stick to the Google TV and avoid other manufacturers too. And that's an issue in of itself. If you can't watch it on your TV, is it going to hurt you?
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see. I mean, this is a market I think that is waiting to happen. Like, we all know that there's something's going to blow out there. We just don't know exactly how. And what I'm not clear about is just whether it's going to be from Hollywood, because I feel like when I watched it, I really felt like this is what Hollywood folks think would be cool on the web. Like, that's how it showed up for me. Like, this isn't. You know, it's like our parents trying to be cool when we were in high school.
I,
you know,
I haven't seen it, but I totally agree with you.
You know, it's just kind of like that's what it really felt like. It
was, well,
like
the fact that they won't even let Tim in to do some social.
Well, that's the whole thing. I think that's the whole thing is that if you're going to do this viral marketing thing, you're going to do all of those things. You're going to have all of that stuff included. Like if actors didn't want to do that, do the viral stuff and do the behind the scenes stuff, I'd be like, we can't have you on the show, because I'd rather have no names that are passionate than names that I can't use.
That's the point. It kind of shows the fact that Tim wasn't allowed to cover them because they weren't doing PR, shows what they think of the investment that they're making in their time in the show. It does. Yeah. It says a lot. It says that they're not willing to get out and walk the walk and talk the talk. And when you see stars of this ilk being willing to talk to Us Magazine about why they're doing backwash, that's when this will change. It's still the perception right now.
Right, and I think you'd be better off with B or C level actors that we all kind of recognize, but we can't quite put their finger on them. I was watching someone on Chase last night, and I was like, I know that guy, but I can't figure out who he is. Like that kind of actor who's mm-hmm. who's got great experience, who's got a great personality, and so on and so forth. Those guys might do better, like, because they're going to be more open to, let's just do whatever we need to do to make this successful. And I know there's a lot of rules. I mean, the hard part with using SAG actors in general is just that there are so many rules to how all that stuff's used, that it kind of takes a lot of the fun out of it. So I think that that's also probably part of the issue. We're going to jump down a couple stories to the app Africa mobile web exploding growth, and this is out of Cape Town. What it's talking about is access to the internet is right now it's reaching about 20% of the population. Wireless connections are reaching 60% of the population. And, it's growing really, really fast. And these are, this is really starting to pick up as far as usage. Opera Mini it shipped to 130 million plus mobile phones. And so here's the real question here is this explosion in, small devices in Africa is... Tim, do you think that Africa might just skip the computer revolution altogether and just move to smartphones?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you take a look at what's happening here. We're turning into a mobile computing world. And I think if you don't have the money to spend and you could only spend it on a few things, you're going to spend it on something that you have with you at all times. You know, people talk about, oh, the experience isn't as great as on a big screen. Well, you don't have your big screen with you all the time, but you do have your phone with you all the time, and that's going to be the device that you consume the most information on. Whether or not you consume the most entertainment on it, another story, but if there's breaking news, if there is something from your family, if there are photos to share, if there are videos to share, you can now do that on a mobile device, and that's huge.
I mean, Daisy, do you see a time when we're actually learning from the African market or from the emerging world markets? I mean, these guys don't have any, they're not tied up with the telco issues, some of the telco issues. They're moving to wireless immediately. They're doing a lot of these other things. Are they going to leapfrog us?
I hope that we can learn from international markets. I'm certainly not any sort of expert on Africa. I know you're much more steeped in what's happening there. But I just know in general, there's so much exciting activity in international markets, with technology and with programming and with distribution, that I think we all need to be looking abroad to see what lessons can be learned for our businesses. I mean, cable programmers are experiencing tremendous growth overseas, in revenues and distribution. And, a lot of the U.S. markets for programming, for instance, is tapped out. But you're finding networks like Discovery, their whole portfolio of networks are, having four times growth overseas, the compared to what they're having in the U.S. or compared to what they're having a few years ago. So I think that if we just, for whatever business that we're in, if we just keep looking within our borders, that's foolish. We need to see what's happening in Africa and in Korea and China and places like that, and to see how people are using technology in different ways. Because a lot of times they're more advanced than we are.
Well, I know. I had never really known what SMS really was when I started. When I was in Africa. This is a decade ago or whatever, or not a decade ago, but eight or 9 years ago. SMS was just kind of this thing that I had heard about, and you'd use it, but it was this weird thing where text would show up on your phone. But when I was in Africa, everybody used it because it was a lot cheaper. Unlike here, where we add, people just get routed, you know, over the price of SMS and, you know, our text messaging. In Africa, it's cheaper to text message than it is to call, because it puts it actually bona fide puts less pressure on the system. And so there's a lot of people who, you know, that almost never call anybody and they just text message everything. And you just got used to that. But it was something that where they kind of got into the, and they know how to, like, you even with these little Symbian phones and everything else. Like, I know how, like, before my iPhone, I pretty much knew how to turn my Trio a little bit, but generally before my iPhone, I just knew how to turn the phone on. I knew how to make a phone call. Sometimes I'd know how to find saved calls, but I didn't know any of the other features, you know, on my phone. And what you'd find with Africans and when I was in Asia, people would know everything about their phone. There's all these crazy things they could do and all these things that they could get done with the phone and everything else, because that was the thing. It's less expensive. It's more portable. It's more available. Lon, do you really think that this is going to be like a huge impact on the overall media market as these emerging countries move completely to mobile? Is this going to change the way we make media here?
Absolutely. I mean, it comes back to the talk we had before about just transporting content over borders, only state borders, but international borders. And, you know, why should there be a delay in someone in Africa wanting to see an American television show until some licensing agreement is met? There's going to be a tremendous amount of pressure now, especially given how fast these mobile connections are to get there. I also think, though, that on a very important level, and you're experiencing this yourself, Alex, because you're doing business over there, that the citizens of these countries are getting a lot more connected, not only to their government, but to the rest of the world.
And I think that that's both good for some of the governments, but it's also been a real headache for a lot of the governments, not just in Africa, but also in Asia, where, you know, flash mobs are, you know, something that China has to worry about, where people can react very quickly. It's very hard to control them when they're able to talk to each other efficiently. So,
and it's good for democracy in the end. And hopefully, especially for Africa, you know, a stronger democracy means a more stable government and certainly a better place to do sometimes, right?
Depending on you know, there are some issues around that, but definitely a stronger community.
And certainly a better place to do business if there's more stability and hopefully more transparency can bring that.
Yeah, transparency, definitely. So our last story of the week, of the day, movie ratings. So this is from the Toronto Sun, and this is talking about, you know, the MPAA. Of course, you know, it's oftentimes been accused of coming down very hard on sex and certain curse words, but seemingly just kind of leaps over graphic violence. So you know, you can see stuff. One of the things they were talking about with King George the Sixth. Is basically one of someone's, you know, drops the F-bomb, and generally it's not that big of a deal. I mean, the rest of the movie is not that big of a deal, but because of the F-bomb, it became a rated R film. There's also, in one of the, in Blue Valentine with Ryan Gosling and Michelle Williams, we've got an NC-17 for an alcohol fueled sex scene between the two leads. And of course people are trying to appeal it. Rated R is one thing. NC-17, you know, really changes the whole outlook for the movie. So the question is Tim, is the system broken? Is it just not working anymore?
I don't know. It's tough to say. I feel like it is. I feel that it really skews to a puritanic American society. But at the same time, it's like you think about people in middle America that have children, and it's like, you know, obviously, they're not going to be going to a rated R movie. Why make it NC-17? Well, because 17-year-olds can get into an R-rated movie on their own. And it's like, man, with video games and everything, really, do we need that? I don't know. I do think that we should take a look at it from a governmental standpoint. Look at me putting regulations on the entertainment industry, because I think right now as a self-policing industry, it seems like it may not be doing the best job possible.
What was the movie that talked about this? I can't remember the name of the movie that was covering that was all about the rating system.
Was it Rated R? Is that the name of the movie?
Wasn't it in Get Shorty when John Travolta joked?
There was a whole movie about it. There was a documentary about the rating system, and it was it was fascinating because he was trying to figure out who is actually doing this and who is actually making these decisions and how are they, you know, and it seems like the big thing is that one of the things, it's a very small number of people making a decision that, you know, affects, and of course from the movie industry, makes a massive impact. I mean, an NC-17 is going to kill a movie's income. You know, because it doesn't. It's not only just that it doesn't go to the movies, but it also doesn't get distributed on Netflix. It doesn't get distributed on all kinds of other things really quickly. If it, you know, at that level, and so it's a very complicated thing. Lon, do people care about these ratings anymore?
I think they do. And by the way, I think this film is not yet rated, right?
Yeah,
is that
that's
the documentary?
It. You're right.
That, I'm going to check that out. It sounds like it might be pretty.
It's fun. It's fun to watch.
I think people do care about ratings. I think it gives a direction for parents, especially what's appropriate for their child. I remember when PG-13 was created around Gremlins. I don't know if you that great movie with the cute little gizmo that turns into the monster, and it was a much more frightening movie than it was marketed as, and that was a PG movie until PG-13 came around. So I think there is some significant value to consumers on that. The NC-17 thing has kind of turned into almost an X rating to the point that it hurts you commercially, and it's almost the nuclear option for these ratings people. And perhaps it's time to look at what that means for theaters and what people are comfortable with presenting, because there's films out there that clearly are not pornographic in nature that are certainly appeal to an audience, but you know, are probably a little bit more than an R rating would be. And it seems like there needs to be some discussion within the film industry, since this is self-policed, about how to deal with those films so that those directors and those writers can have the ability to tell the stories that they want to tell.
I know, as a parent, if something's rated R, I'm not going to let my kids, even my older kids, see it until I see it. You know, like, that's the thing. Like, I don't open, you know, that's all it means to me. Is it doesn't mean that I won't let them see it, but it means that I'm going to go check it out first. You know, or the same thing with a PG-13 is that I will, you know, I'll tend to, you know, think about it for my, when my kids were a little younger, my younger kids, I won't take them to necessarily to a PG-13. But it also is, you know, so I think that those guidelines make some sense to me, but only as pretty rough guidelines. So anyway, so we'll see how that all pans out. Tim, where can people find you?
You can find me on my blog, onetimstreet.com, or check us out at mdialogue.com.
Daisy, where can people find you?
You can find me at daisywhitney.com.
And how's the book going? How's the sales?
It's going really well. Some stores have reported that they've sold out. So that's really great to hear. It's
mine arrived.
Available. Oh, yay. See, you don't have to worry about that with Amazon. It's everywhere. It's in Borders, Barnes & Noble. Indies have been doing well with it. Amazon, obviously, on the Kindle.
Is it true that Martin Sargent and I are dating?
Evidently, I didn't even make that connection, but yes, the main character, a girl, is Alex, and her eventual love interest is named Martin. I guess I had you guys in mind, subconsciously, somehow.
You know, I've often, you know, when I'm wearing a dress, I often think of Martin. You know,
so right, who wouldn't think of Martin?
Who wouldn't? Yeah, he's awesome.
So what's the movie going to be rated?
Hello.
I get to play the nutty professor in it.
Oh, you totally are. You are so the nutty professor, Tim.
Lon, where can people find you?
Find me on Twitter at LONSEIDMAN. And if you're lucky, you'll become my 600th follower. That'd be kind of cool. We'll be having some more space shuttle coverage, hopefully, if we get this discovery off the ground anytime soon. And you can check it out on Twitter. I'll link to the blog I've been keeping on the shuttle launch.
Thank you very much. This mess that you've been listening to is This Week in Media. We are over and out. This Week in Media is a Pixelcore.tv production produced by Suzanne Llewellyn, with technical producers John Riley and Alutha Jaminkar. Content contributor is Jason Perrier.